Welcome to Ballistic Radio. Join us as we discuss hard-won self-defense lessons, as well as the information you need to survive a violent encounter. Listen as armed professionals, industry experts, national champions, and gunfight survivors help answer all your firearms and self-defense questions while exploring your rights and responsibilities as an armed citizen. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. And now, here is your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com. Get the latest behind-the-scenes info, photos, videos, arguments, and other stuff that I probably am not trying nearly as hard at as I should. Affiliate links, things,
Snapchat.
I don't have a Snapchat. I have been featured on a Snapchat, though. Surefire. It was Surefire Snapchat. At facebook.com/ballisticradio. Coasting with me, for now, Jack Jack!
Yay!
Come on, that was funny.
It is funny.
Anyway, we've got a whole bunch of cool things lined up, but for this episode, we're talking with Andrew Branca from the Law of Self-Defense. But before we get to him, guess what?
What's that, John?
This segment brought to you by Tactical Night Vision Company. The night is dark and full of terrors. Or at least, it used to be. Kind of like Petty's basement. But now we have the technology to fight the night. And TNVC is your one-stop shop for all your dark fighting needs. From the TNV PVS-14 Night Vision Goggle to the Maul C1 Plus and everything in between. TNVC can outfit your defense against the dark arts. It doesn't matter if it's your lost keys, the enemy, or that little kid that nobody actually cares about. I should probably take him out of the ad. TNVC has what you need to find things in the dark. TNVC, now with financing. Own or finance tonight.
If my choice was between rescuing that kid we've been talking about for over a year and a Maul, I'd take the Maul.
Yeah. Hands down. Hands down. Anyway, joining us, Andrew Branca. Andrew, how's it going?
Pretty well, John. How about yourself?
Oh, not too bad. Not too bad. It'll get better once I drink the rest of my coffee. But I do have it, and I am consuming it slowly. So life is good. So for those that don't know, you've been on the show before. But say who you are, what you do, and we'll hop right into today's topic.
Sure. My name's Andrew Branca. I'm an attorney. My law practice is law of self-defense. And as the name suggests, we focus our practice entirely on use of force law.
Ah. So, and I apologize, too, for my Midwest pronunciation of your last name. I know the right way to do it, but I can't get the hick to leave. I apologize. I've tried. You know, I went to church, and I even lived in Massachusetts for a while, and I can't do it. I'm sorry. But
the truth, John, is I get interviewed all the time, and then I listen to the recordings back, and I mispronounce my name. So don't feel too bad about it.
My favorite ever is actually when I fill out forms. I did it on a 4473 the other day where I'm filling out the form, and I write my name wrong. And I'm like, huh, well, if this is the kind of day today is, I don't expect it to get any better. But anyway, moving on. So what I'd like to talk about with you, and we were discussing this a little bit before we got on air, And caveat, I actually think that self-defense law and the legalities of self-defense is one of the most overlooked aspects to all of this and one of the most undertrained aspects of all of this there is. So I really highly recommend people spend a little more time on this and then medical training rather than really – and not that you can't work on shooting skills too, but if you have to prioritize them, spend a little more time on this, and you probably already are. But – one of the things that we were talking about is how often people get their idea of what legal self-defense is based off of anecdotal court cases. So can you kind of go into that a little bit, and we'll discuss that?
Sure. I run into this all the time because there's so much disinformation and misinformation out there about what self-defense law actually is. And in a large part, that's driven by people hearing anecdotal stories about other people who've used force in self-defense, and they ended up not getting arrested, not getting prosecuted, not getting convicted, not getting sentenced to spend much of the rest of their life in jail A good example of these anecdotes can be found in any of the NRA magazines, where they have this armed citizen page with little paragraphs about people who use guns to defend themselves. And it always works out great for the good guy and bad for the bad guy. And the cops show up and pat the good guy in the back and everybody's happy.
Right.
But if you actually understand what the law of self-defense is, what the rules are, the rules of engagement for the use of force, and you read many of those little anecdotes, you'll see that in many of those cases, those defenders' use of force was not, in fact, lawful. They made mistakes. They were vulnerable to arrest, prosecution, and conviction. But the authorities chose to use their discretion not to do so. Well, if someone learns from that and concludes that, well, that conduct must have been lawful because they weren't prosecuted, and behaves in a similar fashion and ends up with a different police officer or a different prosecutor or a different jury, the outcome could be wildly different because, in fact, the conduct was unlawful.
Right. Do you think people understand the amount of discretion that prosecutors exercise in what cases they bring to trial or don't bring to trial?
I think they mostly understand it when the prosecutor chooses not to use their discretion in their particular case.
Okay.
Then they show up in my office with a shocked expression on their face. They can't believe that they're being prosecuted.
Right.
Because they know they're the good guy. And if prosecutors are supposed to use discretion, they're certainly supposed to use it to favor the good guy.
Right.
Unfortunately, they don't understand the prosecutor's perspective. From the prosecutor's perspective, his job is to identify people who've acted outside the bounds of the law and to prosecute them. That's not a criticism of prosecutors. That's what we pay them to do. That's their job. And if they've acted, if someone who's normally a law-abiding citizen has in fact acted outside the bounds of the law to a prosecutor, they look exactly like any other criminal case on that guy's desk.
Right, right. Well, and the other thing that people don't seem to realize, too, is that the when laws are exercised only when people decide to exercise them, they're not really laws at that point, you know, as a society. Because that seems to be like one of the, and this is tangential to what we're talking about, but a lot of people get upset about like, well, why did they enforce that law? Why didn't they enforce that law or whatever? If the law is there and they don't enforce it equally, and you start creating protected classes that the law applies to or doesn't apply to, it's not a good situation for anybody.
It's no longer the rule of law.
Yeah, exactly. Which some people seem to be okay with when it applies to their whoever and what. Anyway, Jack's just looking at me like, wow, bro, really? Let's go here. No, let's not. Okay. So as far as what are some examples of behavior that may be acceptable depending on the prosecutor you get, but does not strictly fall into the rule of law?
Well, perhaps the most common example we see is inappropriate defensive display of a firearm.
Okay.
So someone's gone out, they've gotten a concealed carry permit, they strap that pocket rocket into their purse or on their hip or wherever they carry it, and they're out in a parking lot in Walmart sometimes. For some reason, these things happen in Walmarts a lot.
Yeah, actually. I teach a whole class called Don't Go to Walmart. It's actually not called that, but it should be.
And they're approached by somebody who frightens them, and they have a genuine good faith fear that they're about to be hurt, and they end up taking the gun out. Unfortunately, when more rational people come up, like the police, arrive at the scene, and the defender is supposed to be able to explain now what their legal rationale was for displaying the gun, they're not able to articulate any reasonable threat of death or grave bodily harm. The person who was approaching them scared them, but was not displaying a weapon. There was not a great disparity in size and strength. There was not a disparity of numbers. And yet they pointed a gun at them.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't just point a gun at someone because you're scared. If they're only presenting an apparent non-deadly force threat, you don't get to go to your gun.
Right.
You need to have employed some kind of non-deadly means of self-defense. Those people end up getting charged with an aggravated assault. It's good for 10 to 15 years in prison. At best, they'll get offered some kind of plea deal, hopefully with only time served, but it's still a felony conviction on the record. And they believe they only acted in legitimate self-defense. If you put them on a lie detector machine and ask them, were you acting in lawful self-defense, they'd answer yes. They genuinely believe it, so they can't believe they're getting prosecuted. But in fact, of course, their conduct was not within the bounds of the law.
We actually had a case like that. We got about 30 seconds left. We have to go to break, and then we'll get back into that. But We had a case here where a woman was approached by an aggressive panhandler asking for cigarettes. And witness statement to that was he asked for cigarettes. She pulled a gun out and shot him. And that didn't go so well. So it's just kind of exactly what you're talking about. But anyway, talking with Andrew Branca from the Law of Self-Defense, you're listening to Ballistic Radio. The country's leading manufacturer of air rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. This segment brought to you by Wilson Combat. Wilson Combat, makers of the finest custom 1911s and scatterguns since 1977. Legacy of quality, innovation, and service. Learn more about their firearms and accessories at www.wilsoncombat.com. So we are talking with Andrew Branca from the Law of Self-Defense. And before the break, and I'm sorry that I had to interrupt, you were talking about inappropriate display of a firearm and that being one of the most common areas where you see people get charged. Now, there are times when that's appropriate, though, too, aren't there? And doesn't it kind of depend on your local laws?
The laws the black letter of the law tends to be pretty similar from state to state. How it's applied by prosecutors varies enormously.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some scenarios in which I think you have a much better chance of not being prosecuted for a defensive display of a gun, and others in which I think you just don't really have a legally sound argument at all. And the ones that I think are more defensible, because what happens in real life, we all know about the tooler drill, right? Someone comes within 21 feet, even if all they have is an impact weapon, now they've become an imminent threat. I don't want to get into lost in the weeds here. There's a lot of details about the tooler drill that are mistaught sometimes.
Right.
But I just use that as a general framework for our discussion. When someone sees a threat approaching, it's not the case where we walk around with a 21-foot hula hoop and we just wait for that guy to cross the hula hoop line and then we shoot him.
Right.
As the threat becomes closer to being imminent, closer to being at a point where we could use force, we want to be able to take incremental steps towards being able to defend ourselves.
Right.
We want to be able to put our hand on the gun. We want to be able to get the gun out of the holster, go to a low ready, maybe bring the muzzle up. In an effort to be prepared to act in self-defense in a shorter time frame than we would have if we left the gun in the holster until the last second. And arguably, we're doing that guy a favor by taking these incremental steps because it also allows us to delay the point at which we actually have to start sending hot pieces of lead in his direction.
Right.
So we all want to be able to do that. The question is, well, when is it legally defensible to do that? And I think what really differentiates the cases where it is and the cases where it isn't is where the thing that's scaring you, the threat that appears to becoming imminent, if it becomes imminent, would be a deadly force threat. So it's somebody much larger, it's somebody with an apparent weapon, it's a group of people. They're not yet close enough to cause you harm, but when they get close enough, they will be able to cause you death or grave bodily harm. I think in that circumstance, the defensive display of a gun in an effort to deter them from becoming imminent, at which point you'd actually have to start shooting, is defensible. Where people get in trouble is where they see something scary. There's some angry dude who thinks he cut him off in traffic or something like that. And he's coming closer. At some point, he could be an imminent threat, but there's nothing to indicate he would be a deadly force threat.
Right.
So even if he was next to you, he wouldn't be a deadly force threat, and it wouldn't be appropriate to be pointing a gun at him. What people need to do, and the reason people whip out their gun anyway, is simply from the stress of the situation. They're scared, and the gun is all they have, and so they end up going to the tool that they have, and they whip out the gun and end up calling my office.
Right.
What people need to do is they need to be prepared to use a non-deadly means of self-defense, OC spray, taser, jiu-jitsu, whatever it is that they want to have as their non-deadly option. They need to be prepared to use that option so they have something to fill that gap. Because if you look at the FBI stats, we're 5 times more likely to be the victim of a non-deadly force attack against which we can't use a gun than we are to be the victim of a deadly force attack against which we can use a gun.
So let me ask you this. Does the amount of training that a person has received and their ability to articulate perception of the situation affect what their reasonable options are?
Yes, absolutely. Ultimately, what we're doing to justify our use of force or threat of force is articulating our legal rationale.
Right.
But I want to be cautious about using the words articulate and narrative, because a lot of times I hear people use these words and they seem to think that all you need is a story, some kind of story that you can tell that's consistent with the law. That's not enough. You need a story that's evidence-based. You
Right.
need a story that's based on actual facts, observations you can recount. One of the most important things people can do for themselves in self-defense is take a class on things like pre-attack indicators.
Right.
So they can identify what's scaring them, they can articulate what's scaring them, and that builds a very robust narrative that supports their decision to use force. Much more robust. So if you can say the guy's fists were clenched, he was approaching, his face was red, all these kinds of things, he was doing grooming motions, that's a much more robust narrative for why your belief that you needed to use force was reasonable than simply the guy was scaring me.
Right. Well, and that's kind of what I was getting at as far as if... how do I want to frame this question? Does a more highly trained individual, I know they have an advantage for several different reasons. One of them being that I believe they are able to avoid situations that untrained individuals tend to find themselves in for whatever reason. But do they have an advantage after the fact as far as if they can with evidence, like you said, support their account of things, does that change the standard, I guess? Does that change the standard of reasonableness?
Well, it doesn't change the standard per se, but it greatly affects how the prosecutor views the prospects for getting a conviction in that case.
Okay.
You know, we have the physical fight, right? We have the bad guy, and we have us, and we have tools, and we have training, and hopefully we've practiced, we've prepared ourselves for that physical fight. But, of course, there's the legal fight afterwards. And if the prosecutor's looking at prosecuting you, you're his target. And what he needs to overcome, what he needs to be able to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt, is your narrative. That's the stakes in the game. That's his target that he has to destroy
right.
in order to win a conviction. So the more robust your narrative, the less vulnerable you look as a target of successful prosecution, the less likely you're going to go to trial at all, because prosecutors have conviction rates of 90%, 95%, not just because they're good attorneys, although many of them are. It's because they choose which cases to bring to trial, and they only bring to trial cases they believe overwhelmingly they can win. Imagine if your favorite sports team could choose the opponents it was going to play. I mean, they'd have a 90% win rate too. So if you don't look like an easy win, you don't look like an attractive case for him to bring to trial. And that's what we need to look like. We need to look like the toughest file on that guy's desk. Because I can assure you, every prosecutor has far more cases on his desk than he can actually bring to trial.
I'm sorry, you lost me for a second when you used the imagine if your sports team could pick their opponents. And
okay.
I just imagined a Cincinnati Bengals season where we played the Browns all year, and it made me really happy.
Right.
I'm sorry. Anyway, moving on. So how do we do that then? I mean, is there – I know you suggested training and things like that, but what?
Really, to my mind, it's a diversity of training. I think where a lot of people get jammed up, and I'm a firearms instructor myself, we all like to go to the shooting classes. I mean, those are the fun classes.
Right.
But I think a lot of people load up 90% of their training with firing a handgun, when in fact that's probably one of the least likely outcomes that will happen in real life.
Right.
You need to be proficient at that. But I would much prefer to see people spend, you know, 25% of their time on that. Make sure they take a medical class. Make sure they take a pre-attack indicator kind of class. Make sure they take some kind of self-defense law class so that they're a well-rounded defender and are well-positioned to deal with the full variety of attacks that are likely to come their way. Or not even attacks, but threatening situations. Obviously, the goal is to be able to identify the threatening situation even before it's fully developed so you can extract yourself before you have to get into a conflict.
Right. Well, and so we got about a minute left in this segment too, and then we'll continue. But one of the things that you hear a lot in certain circles, at least, is sooner, not faster. And to my mind, being able to recognize the attack and position yourself accordingly beforehand, or remove yourself entirely, is the the definition of sooner, not faster. But anyway, we got to go to break. We'll pick right back up with Andrew Branca from the Law of Self-Defense. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. This segment brought to you by Surefire. No. Your target, and what is beyond it. But how can you really know your target? By shining a really bright light at it, and that's where Surefire comes in. From the USB rechargeable 300 lumen Sidekick to the 500 lumen X300 Ultra or M600 Scout Light, Surefire can make sure you never have to yell, "Aziz Light!" ever again. Doesn't matter if you're shining a light at a potential threat or just helping your friends see through their eyelids. When you need all the lumens for longer, you need Surefire. And now, as a special offer to Ballistic Radio listeners, you can get 30% off the Surefire.com web store, everything except suppressors and batteries, by entering the discount code ALLTHELUMENS, that is ALLTHELUMENS, at Surefire.com. So, and we've got some really exciting things that are happening at Surefire soon. Trademark, soon.
Bum, 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 bum.
But I'm not going to talk about them yet. I will say this, it involves me getting on an airplane, and it sure takes a lot to make that happen. So anyway, we're talking with Andrew Branca from the Law of Self-Defense. Before the break, you were talking about the amount of time that people spend in their training priorities and kind of how you think people focus on shooting a little too much. I was actually, it's funny you bring that up, because I was just considering that the other day, and while, you know, I certainly think that if people want to do things just because they enjoy doing them, that's a perfectly acceptable reason that is not used nearly often enough in life to justify things. If it makes you happy, go do it. Fine. But if you're really seriously interested in self-defense, you know, like you said, pre-attack indicators, something like Craig Douglas's Managing Unknown Contacts, or, you know, a medical class or a law class, probably more important than shaving a tenth of a second off of your build drill, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because, again, you're far more likely to be facing a threat that does not involve going to the gun.
Right.
So shooting's fun, but if you can avoid the fight in the first place, in fact, we run into this in my classes all the time because we spend 6 or 7 hours teaching people the law, and then we run them through a simulator, a high-end TI outdoor simulator system. And one of the things we emphasize in the classroom part, in the teaching part, is to avoid getting into fights you don't need to get into. One of the things I tell people is to keep in mind, the moment you go hands-on in a fight, you've just incurred a greater than zero risk of dying and a greater than zero risk of going to jail for the rest of your life.
Right.
You could do everything right in the fight and still lose the fight. I don't care what kind of draw speed you have. I don't care how many black belts you have. Things could go sideways. It could just not be your day.
Yeah.
And the same happens in the legal context. You could do everything absolutely legally right. I have clients come into my office. They've been charged with something, and their case looks rock solid. And then they're offered a plea, and they don't want to take the plea because they know they're innocent. And I have to tell them, look, you could be the most innocent client that's ever walked into my office, and if we go to trial and you're in front of a jury, there could be up to a 20% chance that you're nevertheless going to go to jail.
Right.
Because things can go sideways. Witnesses can change your story. Evidence can disappear. The jury can be predisposed against someone who uses a gun in self-defense. I mean, we just don't know what's going to happen. So the point of all this is to make sure people understand that there are you don't want to get into fights unless the stakes are worth it, and the stakes are extremely high. The interesting thing we run into then is we take those same people who I've cautioned for hours to not get into fights they don't need to get into. We put them in a simulator. And they start getting killed by the simulator because they won't fight. And what's happened is we've conditioned them so much against fighting that they'll just keep articulating to that video threat over and over and over again until the threat ultimately kills them. And what people need to understand is you don't want to get into fights you don't need to get into, but there are sometimes you do need to fight. And you need to be able to know where that line is, both for yourself morally and for the broader society legally, so that when that moment comes, you can act in self-defense decisively. And if that means using deadly force, then use deadly force decisively. It's where people don't know where that line is, so they end up using force either too early, and get in legal trouble, or too late, and of course that's not a legal problem, that's a survival problem.
Right. You know, and the late trainer Paul Gomez, one of his sayings was, people don't react violently enough, quickly enough, and I'm paraphrasing, but it was, what gets people in trouble the most is they don't react violently enough, quickly enough, when it's justified. Right. And that seems to be something that's missing. Do you think that that stems from a misunderstanding of what justified self-defense is and when they have met the requirement, or when the situation dictates that the requirement has been met, and not just going with it?
People simply haven't conditioned themselves to be prepared. You know, a well-trained pilot, when something goes wrong in his airplane, he's subconsciously competent at what he needs to do to fix that problem. He just starts flipping switches, and he knows how to solve the problem because he's been drilled in it, often in a simulator himself.
Right.
When you've prepared yourself to deal with the crisis, then you can deal with it efficiently. If you haven't, then you have to start thinking about what to do in the midst of the crisis. And under stress, our bandwidth shrinks tremendously.
Yeah.
People need to have thought about these scenarios beforehand, at least in broad terms, so they have some pre-established general strategies for responding to different kinds of threats.
What do you think... How do you think we, you know, as instructors, what do you think we need to do to get people to understand that?
I think people need a lot more kind of role-playing scenarios.
Right.
And people don't like to do this because it makes them uncomfortable. I can tell you when we run people through our simulator, I'll tell them before we put them in, you're going to be scared in the simulator. We know it's a total artificial threat. There's no danger to you at all, but your hands will shake, your voice will get squeaky, your respiration, heart rate will go up, you'll start sweating. And even though I tell them all this, and then we play the video for them and we give them the CERT pistol, their hands start shaking, their voice gets squeaky, their respiration goes up. And stress is uncomfortable for most people. But I really think it's important from a self-defense perspective that we expose ourselves and condition ourselves to being able to operate effectively under stress. One way to do that is through a simulator like I run, or participate in a force-on-force class, or perhaps at even a lower level, just engage in something like competitive shooting, where you have to think and shoot and function under some kind of imposed stress.
Right. And what's funny about that, too, and I'm going to ask Jack his opinion on this as well, having been in a few different violent encounters at this point in my life, and not even necessarily lethal forced violent encounters, but the real-life incidents are never as stressful as the force-on-force or training incidents, it seems. Jack, have you noticed that?
Absolutely. Like, there is actual... things helping you there. Like there's some sort of buffer. There's probably a medical term for it where mentally you're not as stressed. You've got that real adrenaline. Everything is going and you're not surrounded by your peers who are judging your every action.
Well, sometimes you are. I have had my friends laugh at me when somebody was kicking me, but that is only,
you know,
once.
It's a different matter.
Yeah.
But yeah, the more training you do, the more stress you expose yourself to, the less you'll be shocked by it,
right,
when it happens for real.
And maybe it's just that familiarity, but so what are some other anecdotal things that get people in trouble, Andrew, as far as, because we sort of talked about preemptive displays of firearms, how when that's not appropriate it can cause issues. What else have you noted?
And another huge one is when people go to the gun in defense of property.
Wow.
So they see somebody messing with their property, or even worse, they see somebody messing with someone else's property. And in many states, you have absolutely zero right to use any force, even non-deadly force, in defense of some stranger's property.
Right.
And they see this happening, and they act impulsively, or they think of themselves as kind of a sheepdog of the community. They want to intervene. They want to stop this evildoer. And they whip out their gun in a property situation. And there are very few circumstances in which you can use deadly force in defense of property. In most states, it's just a blanket prohibition. But if you read those armed citizen columns in the NRA magazine, you'll see lots of stories about people who use guns in defense of property, and it all works out for them. Well, it works out because the prosecutors chose not to bring charges against them.
Right. Let me interrupt because we have to go to break. Right now we're talking with Andrew Branca from the Law of Self-Defense. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. So we're talking with Andrew Branca from the Law of Self-Defense. And you were pointing out before the break, Andrew, that one of the other issues that a lot of people run into is defending property and ending up using lethal force when that's not justified. And it works out for some people because the prosecutor just decides not to prosecute them. And then I had to interrupt you for the break. I apologize. I think you were going to elaborate on that further.
Well, it's just another one of those examples where people hear these stories and they think, well, this guy wasn't prosecuted, so it must be okay to do that. It must be okay to use a gun in defense of personal property. Then they do it, and they can't believe that they're getting prosecuted, that they're facing a serious prospect of going to jail for much of the rest of their lives because they simply didn't know what the rules are. Another common situation is people intervening in other people's fights.
Right.
They see some kind of dispute going on, often it's a dispute that I can sympathize with the desire to intervene. Some guy's beating up a woman in public. Nobody wants to see that happen. But they intervene, and then afterwards it turns out the woman starts telling a different story than right. What actually happened, because this is her baby daddy, and he's going to go to jail over Christmas again, and she doesn't want her kids not to have their father around, and suddenly her story changes. Her story isn't she was getting the crap beat out of her in the street by this guy. The story is that they were arguing, but that's what they do all the time. It's the nature of their relationship. The only time she was really scared is, guess what? When you showed up with a gun and started waving it around.
Right.
And if that's the – and you know, that's evidence. It might be false, but that's evidence that a prosecutor can use to build a compelling narrative that your use of force, your threat of force, was not justified. And again, you end up with an aggravated assault charge that's good for 10 or 15 years and spending – best case scenario – you spend a lot of money on a guy like me and you end up not going to jail.
Right. Well, and a lot of people, it seems like a lot of people don't understand the concept of like a Pyrrhic victory, where the cost of winning is so high that it's better just not to have fought to begin with. And most self-defense scenarios that I can think of, pretty much all of them, I can think of a couple exceptions. But for the most part, just avoiding the situation is, whenever possible, is better.
I try to remind people that you get into a fight, you could die in that fight.
Yeah.
You could go that bad. But people can't absorb that because we all believe we're immortal. So instead, I try to focus on the financial costs.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's more real to people. They understand what money is. None of us has enough of it. We all have things we want to get that we can't afford. And I can tell you that if you threaten or use force against another person and the authorities choose to bring charges against you, the entry fee from a legal cost perspective is in the range of $25 to $30. And that's to get to a preliminary hearing. That's not even getting to trial. So we're talking a pretty nice car because you whipped that gun out.
So I'm sorry, could you repeat that figure just one more time in case people didn't hear you?
Sure. $25,000 to $30,000 non-refundable retainer to get to a preliminary hearing.
Right.
In a use of force case.
Yeah.
And if we actually get the trial, then we're talking potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars, of course. But even assuming the best case scenario, you get to the preliminary hearing, your defense attorney makes his case, and the prosecutor decides, all right, forget it, we'll drop the charges. You've already incurred $25,000 to $30,000 in legal costs.
Right. Well, and that's assuming that you have that money to spend. If you don't and you end up stuck with the public defender, some of them are very good. Some of them are not very good. And it just...
Yeah, that's quite right. Some of them are world-class, I have to say, but a lot of them are fresh out of law school, not very experienced, and all of them are way, way overworked.
Yeah. Something to think about. So we got 4 or 5 minutes left at least, but I just want to make sure that we have time for it. If people want to come take a class with you or want to find out more of kind of what you do or just get more information, how can they do that?
The best way is just go to our website, which is lawofselfdefense.com. And there we have information about our books, about our live classes, and we do about 40 of those a year all over the country, actually more than that now. We also have online classes, which are the equivalent of our full-day live classes. We have an instructor program that's totally online. It can be streamed to your laptop or tablet or phone. And, of course, we also do a lot of legal consulting work for other attorneys around the country. But lawofselfdefense.com would be the place to go to learn all about that.
Perfect. Now, do you have any special events that are going on right now? Or
indeed, indeed we do. For the month of April, we're running a 25% off sale.
Nice.
On everything we do except the live classes. We can't discount the live classes because there's so much travel cost overhead with those. But our books, our online courses, our instructor program, and that can be combined with we always have a 15% discount for anyone who is currently or has ever been military, law enforcement, or first responder. So they can add that 15% to the 25%, get 40% off. And on our instructor program, for example, that would save them $400 right there.
Nice. And your instructor program is certainly on my list of things that I will absolutely do at some point as soon as time and funds allow. But I really, for everybody listening, I cannot recommend The Law of Self-Defense enough. It's an amazing book that you can buy on Amazon. The classes, while I have not been to one, I plan on going. So I guess we've got a couple minutes left, I think. So about three. Thank you, Joe. What is your most hated piece of inaccurate information that is relayed in regards to self-defense? Do you have one thing that just gives you the Forrest Whitaker eye and you wish you could make not exist anymore?
Yeah, the biggest one is all the mythology about how people are going to alter the scene in order to make their use of force look like it was self-defense. They're going to drag the body into the house. They're going to drop a knife next to the body, things of that sort. And it's in the law, we call that consciousness of guilt evidence. It's evidence that you yourself believe you didn't act lawfully or you wouldn't be tampering with the scene. And this inevitably gets discovered. You know, you shoot a bunch of holes in somebody and you drag them up the stoop of your house. You don't need to be CSI to figure out what just happened. There's a big red blood smear on the sidewalk.
Right.
You drop a knife next to somebody. They test that knife. It has your DNA all over it because you carried it in your pocket for 5 years. They know that's your knife. It's not the other guy's knife. And now the prosecution can present this consciousness of guilt evidence to the jury and essentially argue to the jury that not only does he believe you're guilty, you believe you're guilty or you wouldn't have done this. And that's utterly fatal to a self-defense claim.
Right. Well, the one that I always run into online, make sure you drag them inside after you. It's like, what? Why? Let me ask you this real quick, too. We only got about a minute and a half left, I think. But recently was a case where a guy found somebody showering in their rental property, went back to their office, retrieved a gun, which was a different building, mind you, came back and shot the guy in the shower through the shower curtain. Is that guy going to jail, do you think?
Straight up murder.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to argue you were in fear of death or grave bodily harm when you leave, secure a position of safety, then arm yourself and go back to the threat and set aside the fact that the threat in this case was a naked dude in a shower.
Right. Right. Never mind. I was going to make a joke. I decided not to, which is probably good for everybody. So as far as that goes, is that just where somebody, we've got a minute left, so scratch that. What I'll do is save that question for the next time you're on, Andrew. Thank you so much for joining us. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, John. Happy to be on anytime. Say hi to Jack for me.
Oh, I will.
I'm right here.
He's the big guy. He's the big guy there.
In that case, say hi to Melody for me.
That I will do. That I will do. Hey, you enjoy the rest of your day, sir. So
you too, John.
Thanks. Hey, make sure you check out our website, ballisticradio.com, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio. And hey, keep leaving those 5-star review on iTunes. We really appreciate it. It helps us out. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe. See you next week.